feel a little bit like a greyhound out of the gate. There's sort of this unspoken etiquette when you do a Dharma talk that you wait till everyone's seated. So we'll be like, just about to talk, and one more person. One more person. Two more people. So I realized in writing my Dharma talk that I'm getting old. When you try, when I give a talk, to think of an illustration for any point that I would want to make, and I realized that sort of the stories that I refer to are further and further back in time. I don't know who that character actor is in the Westerns, but he was always that old guy who'd always say, "Well, by gum, I think that was back in '83. But I was reminded of a story back in the ashram days. I lived in ashram for a couple decades, and we did a lot of intensive practice. And we're always doing different things to try to inspire ourselves in our practice. And there was one teacher who was a good friend of mine who decided that at random, when we would be in postures, he would ring a bell and open the Bhagavad Gita to any random page and just read something that we would contemplate while we were in the posture. I remember it was about 5 o'clock in the morning, and maybe about 75 or 80 of us in this room, and it was very, very dark, you know, just one little candle where he was had his the Bhagavad Gita, and we were all in the headstand. So there was this one little ding, and I'll just paraphrase what he read, but it was at random out of the Gita that said, to take human incarnation and to hear the Dharma is an incredible blessing. And to actually contemplate the Dharma is an even rarer occurrence. And someone who actually engages into honest practice, rarer still. And out of those very, very few, out of the millions who take human form, one in every 500 years will become fully realized. There's this silence. And then there was this upside down voice in the back of the room that said, "Gee, thanks, that's encouraging." And then there was a sound I never heard before, which I may never hear again, which was 75 people falling out of the headstand. So why do I share that story? Sometimes in our practice, it can feel hopeless. And it can feel like it's a never-ending slog. As I was quoting in one of our small groups the other day, this great quote I heard from a teacher who said that meditation is one insult after another. But the question is, what is this awakening? What is this enlightenment? Is it something that only occurs after lifetime after lifetime of arduous work? Does it happen in a lightning strike? There's a quote from scripture that says, "O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the Buddhas, of the awakened ones, remember who you really are." And that's the directive. To remember who you really are. Hugh kind of outlined the map of the practice for us. Tara kind of exposed us to the main entrance of working through the body. Pat helped us to guide our attention to look at awareness itself. And tonight I'd like to talk a little bit about the nature of the practice, about the flowering of the practice, and the expression of the practice in the world. And really, what I'd like to talk about is what's called the awakening of bodhicitta, the awakening of the heart and the awakening of the mind. When I first started teaching Vipassana, at the end of a Dharma talk, someone asked me, "Is meditation something I'm supposed to work at or something I'm supposed to relax into? It kind of stunned me for a moment, and I said, yes. You relax and you pay attention. And different teachers and different traditions will emphasize one aspect or another. And then you learn how to balance it for yourself. The two elemental questions, what is happening right now? Can I be with it? These are the two questions that awaken bodhicitta. What is happening right now? The wisdom faculty. Can I be with it? The compassion faculty. So a 2-minute reflection. If you'd like, you can just close your eyes. You don't have to get any special super meditation position. Can you feel this paradox right now? This paradox of being alert and at the same time relaxed. Can you feel this inner state of being attentive to all the details of what is happening right now, and at the same time, a capacity to let your experience be in a flow state, to allow it to change? Can you sense this awareness of the foreground? Of what is here. And at the same time, can you sense the background? A sense of space, maybe a sense of who you are as the observer or the witness, or maybe even something beyond the witness, something that can't be located. What would you call that? Presence? Being? Space, cognizance. So if you like, you can let your eyes open, or you can remain with them closed if you prefer. So we're here and now, and it's New Year's Eve. The wheel keeps on turning, another year. And maybe you've given some thought as to what's waiting for you after lunch tomorrow. Maybe. At the last month-long retreat I went to at Spirit Rock, at the end of the retreat, I was all packed up, and I met with the teacher for my final interview and before catching my flight back to D.C., and you know, I thanked him and expressed my gratitude for how clear I felt and how ready I was to kind of move on to the next thing. And he looked at me and he said, do you realize that there are 2 days left? That was embarrassing. So how long have you had your bags packed? By the way, that retreat was during the big snowstorm here, Snowmageddon, here in D.C. So while Tara and her mom were snowed in for 8 days, I was walking barefoot in the hills of Marin County, just blissing out with the fog coming in and the fog going. So who knows what disasters you've averted by being here. My teacher used to say one of the benefits of spiritual practice is not just the benefit you get right out of the practice, but the trouble you avoid by not being out there in your life. So back to these two questions. What is happening? Can you be with it? The first Vipassana retreat I went to was given a very simple instruction to give yourself fully and then evaluate whether it was a benefit or not. And these instructions are really part of this investigation, to see clearly what is happening right now, to see how you're relating to it, to sense how you are being present in your heart and in your awareness. Pat pointed out the instruction of noting the attitude that you have in the mind when something is arising. And then to notice how you can respond with kindness and with wisdom. And I think this is how we are constantly in our practice. We give ourselves to it. We evaluate honestly. Has this expanded me in some way? Has this contributed in some way? And then we respond. More of this, less of that. Pat talked about developing yourself as a contemplative artist. I love that description. Because ultimately, your path is a very intuitive one. There's this wisdom faculty that will intuitively guide you. Maybe you need to sort of tighten up, to concentrate, to pay attention a little more, to kind of calm a ragged and wild mind with concentration. Maybe you need to relax a little. Maybe you need to unwind and open up more. This middle way, not too tight, not too loose. It's a moving target. And it takes clarity and it requires honesty to see what's really happening and how you're relating to it. Honesty is a really critical part of this practice. Have you ever been in an argument and realized that you're wrong? It's that kind of honesty. To see clearly what's happening. And this is the path. Or as Hugh would put it, this is the path. It's just so cool the way he says it. So something drew you here. Something intuitive called you to practice. And you've applied yourself as best as you could. You've applied will. You've applied effort. And you've explored surrender. And you may sense what has begun to flower from both your effort and your capacity to allow and to surrender. So I'd like to talk about a few things. What is this flowering that occurs when we practice? And how do we express it? How does it naturally express in the world? So I love reading stories about enlightenment. You know, when you read scripture, you'll hear these stories of someone stops the Buddha in the road, you know, and they ask him a question three times, and the Buddha responds, and he is enlightened. Never really sure what that meant. But what is the end result? What is the flowering of the practice? Different teachers and different traditions will give you different answers. Some will say the result is freedom from suffering. Some will say happiness. Some might say there is ultimate freedom, but also incremental freedom. Less reactive, less grasping. Some might say it is the release of the self. Others might say it is a lessening of the three poisons of greed, of hatred, and delusion. I asked Sokni Rinpoche about what would be the result of a continued practice. And his response so surprised me. He said, confidence. You will become confident that you can be with anything. That really touched me. Yoga describes the Jivan Mukti, being fully awake in your body. Is that possible? To be awake in your body with all of your responsibilities, your desires, your dreams, your stories, your commitments? Other traditions might describe this state by what it is not. Gandhi talked about ahimsa, the absence of violence. Avidya, the absence of confusion. So another little 2-minute check-in, if you like. You can close your eyes. It might be interesting just to explore this. What is this state described by what it is not? Just sensing, however you may intuit it, this place of non-grasping, of non-clinging. A state of non-seeking. We might consider it as the absence of the hindrances, of who you are in the absence of judging, who you are in the absence of wanting anything different than how it is, who you are in the absence of worry, in the absence of sloth, in the absence of doubt. And again, if you like, you can open the eyes or remain with them closed. So as best as I can tell, the two main faculties wake up in this practice. Awareness or wisdom, the capacity to grasp what is true, and compassion, the capacity to be with it, to bear it. And Buddhism calls this bodhicitta. You begin to recognize what's actually happening in your practice. Not your version, not your embellishment, not your preference, but what's actually happening. We begin to contact the ground of reality, the three marks of existence, the recognition of impermanence, the recognition that everything is in a constant state of change. The insight into suffering, that your relationship to what is changing directly determines the degree that you'll suffer. Any resistance to change results in stress and dissatisfaction, in unsteadiness and suffering. And you begin to see into the nature of the self, that there is a relative self in this world of duality. And sometimes we can sense or taste or just feel that absolute self, the self that is not just the wave but the ocean itself. Also, in our practice, we begin to sense the embodiment of this practice, that this is not just happening in the mind. We realize that thoughts and feelings live in the body, and that we can transform our experience by hanging out on that level. We begin to realize the richness of the body, that your body came through another body, through your mother's body. It feels, it smells, it sees, it hears, it tastes. And perhaps you also realize this awakening of the heart. Pat described Indra's net, this web, and at every interface of the web there is this jewel which reflects the rest of the mirror back. And we begin to sense the interconnectedness of everything. A recognition that what you feel, other people feel too. That another's suffering is connected with yours. So many insights shared this week in the small groups. And stories of those who were in conflict with another and just spontaneously began to sense the other's point of view, of seeing into to the nature of another person's suffering. That small, tight self opens, maybe just for a moment. And with that, the heart cracks open. So perhaps you have been touched by the suffering around you this week. Feeling or sensing someone near you has been suffering, or seeing someone who you might sense is struggling, and feeling yourself perhaps just touched by that, or informed by someone who shared about working through something really challenging. And so little by little we become more in contact with what's true, and we feel the heart resonating, we feel the heart quivering. And the interesting thing is how on retreat, how this transformation happens by itself. We can't make it happen. All we can do is to create an optimal internal environment for it to happen. All we can do is relax and pay attention. And so transformation happens. I was sharing in one of the groups one of my favorite stories from Pema Chodron, who said after meditating for 45 years, she's never had a breakthrough. She was really jealous of other people who've had breakthroughs. Always wanted to have a breakthrough. But when she looked back, she saw this incremental, gradual awakening. You may have had some incredible insights, some incredible breakthroughs this week. Maybe some subtle. Maybe none. My first 10-day retreat, I felt decidedly worse at the end. Worse in a good way. It was transformative, but it wasn't tied up in a neat little bow at the end of the retreat. And you may not feel that way either. So when I look at wisdom and compassion, I've really come to see that the most interesting and the most stimulating people are often the ones who've suffered the most. And they've come through it with a sense of wisdom and compassion awakened. Somehow their suffering opened something inside. Rather than calcifying and getting small and tight into resentment, something has opened. Elie Wiesel wrote, "I have learned that suffering confers no privileges. It depends on what one does with it." This is why survivors have tried to teach their contemporaries how to build on ruins, how to invent hope in a world that offers none, how to proclaim faith to a generation that has seen it shamed and mutilated. We experience suffering all the time. Sometimes more poignant moments than others. For me, this last year has had a lot of close encounters with sickness, old age, and death. With my parents dying, going through their process of transitioning. Of really being in the question, can I be with this? Watching both my parents moving into dementia at different times. Seeing their brain deteriorate, and hearing them talk as if they're just narrating a lucid dream. Can I be with it? I once sat very deeply in that question, and a phrase popped to mind which I had heard before. And the phrase was, practicing wholehearted cooperation with reality. And that kind of became my rallying cry. That when I would be with my parents, a clear intention to cooperate wholeheartedly with reality. And it created a shift for me. It helped me shift from being self-protective and afraid to actually being curious, to be able to step up, to meet that process. Sometimes what wakes us up are these heavenly messengers of sickness, old age, and death. the Buddha taught, how when you allow these in, when you truly allow them in, how they can radically transform your life. There's a story of a woman who asked the Buddha for some counsel. She said, I am doing all the practices that you've prescribed, but I don't feel passion, I don't feel engaged. Can you offer me some guidance? The Buddha's response struck me as rather brutal. He said, do this. Every night before you go to bed, contemplate the fact that everyone in your household will die in no particular order, and you will find passion coming into your practice. Years ago, I was complaining to Tara about a Dharma talk, and I couldn't think of anything to say. And she said, if you only had one talk to give before you died, what would you say? That was a powerful gift. It reframed things in a big way. So we suffer a lot about the question of our work in the world, our individual expression, our individual dharma. The Bhagavad Gita says, one's own dharma performed imperfectly is better than another's dharma well performed. So what is your purpose? What is your path? A very painful inquiry sometimes is to ask, are you living your life as fully as you want to? What is between you and living fully? There's a phrase that says, finding your dharma is your dharma. Finding your path is your path. Many years ago, when I was in high school, I took one of the classes where it was in kind of art and architecture, and I had to build a model. And I chose to build a model on my aunt's house in Maine. She's this old fishing cottage. And I hated every minute of it. But I had this awful-looking model at the end, and I gave it to her for Christmas. And as I gave it to her, I said, I hated doing this. You can throw this away if you want. I loved her response. She said, this is excellent. Now you know you don't want to be an architect. When we ask ourselves, what is my path? What is my expression? Sometimes we need to make external changes. Sometimes we need to make internal changes. A couple years ago, I was kind of working this issue with someone. He worked in a very high, intense job. He has super high security clearance, and all the decisions were very, very intense. And he was debating, do I go? Do I find something else? Do I stay? And he decided to stay and kind of work on the internals. And he did a lot of retreats, very, very dedicated practitioner. I hadn't seen him for maybe a year or so, but I saw him a few weeks ago. And I asked him about work. And he said, oh, it's gotten so easy. He said, I managed to say what's true and put it out there in a way that no one resists what I'm saying, mainly because now I'm not resisting anyone. And I love that story because he didn't change the externals, he changed the internals. So here's a little reflection of bringing in the heavenly messengers as an aid to sensing Dharma and your path. If you like, you can close your eyes. So I'm going to offer just a few questions and give you maybe 15 or 20 seconds just to kind of spontaneously entertain whatever comes into mind. If you had a year to live, what would you do? What would be most important? If you had a month to live, what would you do? What would be most important? If you had a week to live, what would you do? What would be most important? If you had an hour to live, if you had one breath, if you like, you can let the eyes open, remain with them closed. Our sense of our Dharma, of our purpose, of our expression on the world is directly impacted by the clarity of mind and the clarity of heart. There's an important point from something Pat said last night, which is really key to kind of the rest of what I'd like to talk about. And that is, when your sense of self dissolves, compassion arises. And from this, some great, powerful global teachings have arisen from all the great traditions. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. See the self in other, and other in self. All great traditions speak to service as a path of transformation and a path of expression of our true nature. In the yoga tradition, there is the word seva, S-E-V-A, which translates as selfless service. It was something in our community that we took on in a very big way. The idea of practicing selflessness in all that we do. Of really being in that constant question, how can I help? We practice something in the yoga tradition that's called Aditi Devo Brahma, which translates as the guest is God. Whoever is in front of you is divine. Really powerful practice. And I find myself coming back to that place. In about 2 weeks, I'm going to be in a recording studio for 4 days creating a product. And when I think about it, and I kind of get into comparing or wanting it to be a certain way, I get really tight inside. When I can reframe it as to how can I create something that really serves, I relax. I can feel something opening up again inside. So it's interesting to see the relationship between the self and our capacity for generosity. I had heard of a story, a study years ago on generating income in abundance. That, you know, what they saw is that if you are trying to make money just for yourself, there's a certain kind of limit that people tend to have. When you are generating income for your family to provide for, you know, for the well-being, for education, for children, you sort of expand your capacity to actually earn and receive. And if you're tied into a cause, into something really big, you actually increase your capacity to both receive and give kind of exponentially. So it's like the more the more you get out of the way, the more you kind of open your bandwidth to both receive and to pass it on. So I'd like to talk a little bit about kind of the classical teachings on service, or the path of the Bodhisattva. We've been on silence this week. May have been hard for you, might have been a real pleasure. For me, in the beginning of retreats, it felt like an austerity, like I was sort of closing down something that was really kind of enjoyable. Over time, I became to really love the silence, it really being nourishing. But I had a very interesting shift in perspective. My guru's guru practiced silence for 19 years. Once a year, he would speak at a kind of a formal ceremony. And I realized, as he was describing it, that actually going into silence wasn't a discipline. Coming out of silence was a discipline. That making a break from that place of just pure presence in the duality was actually kind of painful. In that same way, when we step onto a path of service, it can come from a sense of duty, from a sense of something we should do. But it can also be a natural, organic expression of consciousness. You know, when you're in a good mood, you can't help but be nice. Generosity is effortless. You're just opening doors for people because you just feel so darn good. I'm not naturally so kind in DC traffic. I get really irritated, and I've been known to utter some oaths aloud. But if I'm feeling good, I kind of surprise myself. I'm waving people across the intersection. No, my good man, after you. It's been described as a rain cloud, that when you are full, you can't help but shower. So I'd like to offer a little reflection of taking this stance of service. If you like, you can again close your eyes. And if you like, you might bring into mind someone with whom you have a conflict, or just a feeling of separation. You might not choose your arch nemesis, but maybe scale it down a little bit. Someone with whom you felt some challenge. If you were to step into a generous stance, and if you were able to do a role reversal, what do you imagine this person needs from you? And if you were able to offer this, what would that feel like? What would that be like for the other? And so deepening the breath, and if you like, again, letting the eyes open. So back to these three elements I had mentioned earlier, of seeing clearly what is happening, sensing how you're holding it, and sensing how you can respond. We see suffering all the time. How do we respond? And Jack Kornfield was quoting Stephen Hawking, who said, it's actually not that difficult. It's kind of like at a third grade level. Should we build more schools or build more missiles? Should we feed hungry people or give money to corporations? We can look through one lens and and really feel how incredibly discouraging and how heartbreaking it is right now in the world. The suffering that we inflict on each other in this culture, the desensitization to violence, the access to tools of violence and weapons, the split between the haves and the have-nots, is it's almost unprecedented. So it's easy to get discouraged. But as the saying goes, better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. And so it comes down to intention. Before every action, there's an intention. I'm hungry, I need to eat. I'm tired, I need to sleep. And the question is, can we make our intention in the world conscious? We have our short-term intentions and our long-term intentions. And the Bodhisattva vow is very powerful. Talk about a long-term intention. Let me read this to you. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to liberate them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transcend them. Dharma teachings are boundless. I vow to master them. The Buddha's enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Wow. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to liberate them all. What about those who don't want to be saved by you? That vow is repeated in monasteries around the world. To have that intention to serve. And while that may seem exalted, each of us in our own way has to find a way to articulate that for ourselves so that you can have an intention that you come back to when you encountering not just suffering around you, but suffering inside as well. When Tara and I got married, we made our own form of the Bodhisattva vow. And that intention has been very powerful for me. And the way that we created it, may whatever arise serve the awakening of heart and mind and be of benefit to all beings. That's been tremendously helpful for me when I found myself caught in feeling tight or separate, to remember that intention. For me, when I watched my father, when he no longer knew who I was, when he became incontinent, when he could no longer stand, to remember that intention, wholehearted cooperation with reality, realigned myself. When conflict arises in relationship, may this serve the awakening, reminds me what's most important. So each of us has to generate that intention. I'd like to read for you a wonderful prayer by Diane Ackerman. If you like, you can close your eyes and just sense how she articulated this intention in these words. In the name of daybreak and the eyelids of morning and the wayfaring moon and the night when it departs, I swear I will not dishonor my soul with hatred, but offer myself humbly as a guardian of nature, as a healer of misery, as a messenger of wonder, as an architect of peace. In the name of the sun and its mirrors and the day that embraces it and the cloud veils drawn over it and the uttermost night and the male and the female and the plants bursting with seed and the crowning seasons of the firefly and the apple, I will honor all life wherever and in whatever form it may dwell, on earth my home and in the mansion of the stars. when we consciously take on an intention to serve, when this tight, knotted self begins to dissolve and we begin to feel the natural expansion of the heart, we can become a force. I'd like to read for you a reading I found powerful. This is by the British writer Bernard Hare. In 1982, he had an experience that changed him profoundly. He was a student living just north of London, and he tells this story to inspire troubled young people, to help them deal with their disrupted lives. The police called at my student hovel early evening, but I didn't answer as I thought they'd come to evict me. I hadn't paid my rent in months. But then I got to thinking, my mom hadn't been feeling too good, and what if it was something about her? We had no phone in the hovel, and mobiles hadn't been invented yet, so I had to nip down to the phone box. I rang home to Leeds to find my mother was in hospital and not expected to survive the night. "Get home, son," my dad said. I got to the railway station to find I'd missed the last train. A train was going as far as Peterborough, but I would miss the connecting Leeds train by 20 minutes. I bought a ticket home and got on anyway. I was a struggling student and didn't have the money for a taxi the whole way, but I had a screwdriver in my pocket and my bunch of skeleton keys. I was so desperate to get home that I planned to nick a car in Peterborough, hitchhike, steal some money, something, anything. I just knew from my dad's tone of voice that my mother was going to die that night, and I intended to get home if it killed me. "Tickets, please," I heard as I blankly stared out the window at the passing darkness. I fumbled for my ticket and gave it to the guard when he approached. He stamped it, but then just stood there looking at me. I'd been crying, had red eyes, and must have looked a fright. "You okay?" he asked. "Of course I'm okay," I said. "Why wouldn't I be? And what's it got to do with you, in any case?" "You look awful," he said. "Is there anything I can do?" "You could get lost and mind your own business," I said. "That'd be a big help." I wasn't in the mood for talking. He was only a little bloke, and he must have read the danger signals in my body language and tone of voice, but he sat down opposite me anyway and continued to engage me. "If there's a problem, I'm here to help. That's what I'm paid for." I was a big bloke in my prime, so I thought for a second about physically sending him on his way, but somehow it didn't seem appropriate. He wasn't really doing much wrong. I was going through all the stages of grief at once: denial, anger, guilt, withdrawal, everything but acceptance. I was a bubbling cauldron of emotion, and he had placed himself in my line of fire. The only thing I could think of to get rid of him was to tell him my story. "Look, my mom's in the hospital dying, and she won't survive the night. I'm going to miss the connection to Leeds at Peterborough, and I'm not sure how I'm going to get home. It's tonight or never. I won't get another chance. I'm a bit upset, and I don't really feel like talking, and I'd be grateful if you leave me alone, okay?" "Okay," he said, finally getting up. "Sorry to hear that, son. I'll leave you alone then. Hope you make it home in time." Then he wandered off down the carriage, back the way he came. I continued to look out the window in the dark. 10 minutes later, he was back at the side of my table. "Oh no," I thought, "here we go again. This time I'm really going to rag him down the drain." He touched my arm. "Listen, when we get to Peterborough, shoot straight over to platform 1 as quick as you like. The Leeds train will be there." I looked at him dumbfounded. It wasn't really registering. "Come again?" I said stupidly. "What do you mean? Is it late or something?" "No, it isn't late," he said defensively, as if he really cared whether trains were late or not. "No, I've just radioed Peterborough. They're going to hold the train for you. As soon as you get on it, it goes. Everyone will be complaining about how late it is, but let's not worry about that on this occasion. You'll get home, and that's the main thing. Good luck and God bless." Then he was off down the train again. Tickets, please. Any more tickets now? I suddenly realized what a top-class, fully-fledged jerk I was. And I chased him down the train. I wanted to give him all the money in my wallet, my driver's license, my keys, but I knew he would be offended. I caught him up and grabbed his arm. I was suddenly speechless. It's okay, he said. Not a problem. He had a warm smile on his face and true compassion in his eyes. He was a good man for its own sake and required nothing in return. I wish I had some way to thank you, I said. I appreciate what you've done. Not a problem, he said. If you feel the need to thank me, the next time you see someone in trouble, you help them out. That will pay me back amply. Tell them to pay you back the same way, and soon the world will be a better place. I was at my mother's side when she died in the early hours of the morning. Even now, I can't think of her without remembering the good conductor of the late night train to Peterborough. And to this day, I won't hear a bad word said about British Rail. My meeting with a good conductor changed me from a selfish, potentially violent hedonist into a decent human being, but it took time. I've paid him back 1,000 times since then, I tell the young people I work with, and I'll keep on doing so until the day I die. You don't owe me nothing, nothing at all. And if you think you do, I give you the same advice the good conductor gave me. Pass it down the line. So I'd like to close by kind of connecting the dots back to the first point I made. This practice includes both will and effort, and surrender and letting go. Sometimes you will naturally experience the spaciousness of effortless presence. Sometimes you're going to have to apply some effort to call your attention back into one place, to calm the mind so that you come home again. Sometimes you'll feel a natural, organic impulse to give and serve and be a contribution to others. Sometimes you'll be a gnarly, tight little resentful clod who will have to remember your intention. Let's close with a little meditation. I'd like to lead a little meditation inspired by Ayakema. You might imagine or feel that you are breathing in peace and breathing out love. On your next in-breath, fill yourself with peace wherever you think it may come from the night sky, from this room, from the mystery. And as you breathe out, offer this to yourself, to the cells of this body. Breathing in peace and breathing out love, you might extend it to the person next to you. Breathing in peace, breathing out love. You might imagine it like a light spreading from your body to those in your immediate circle. You might think of your parents, whether they're alive or whether they've passed. Breathing in peace, breathing out love. Thinking of those who are the nearest and the dearest to you. Breathing in peace, breathing out love. Those you work with, those you see on a regular basis. Anyone you know who may be sick, not feeling well, breathing in peace, breathing out love to that person. Anyone you know who may be going through a difficult time, breathing in love, breathing out peace. Sensing all living things. All beings in all directions without discrimination. Breathing in peace, breathing out love. This planet, infinite space, and as you sense the infinity of space, at the same time feeling this vessel, this body, each cell of the body, Namaste.